Welcome to Tooled Up Education's Researcher of the Month, where the Tooled Up team selects a paper from a notable researcher that will be of interest to parents and school staff everywhere.
Julie Moot started out as a science teacher, but has been an academic researcher for a decade and is now a freelance research and evaluation consultant. Her most significant project has been the ASPIRES investigation. ASPIRES was a huge longitudinal study which followed a cohort of students over a 13-year period, from primary school leavers through to university graduates and young people transitioning into the world of work, investigating how their aspirations for education and then work in STEM-related disciplines formed and developed over time. The findings of this project have been reported to Parliament and are informing government policies on how to encourage more young people to get into STEM careers. Broadening the pursuit of STEM is one of Julie's main passions, particularly making STEM a safer and more inclusive space for people of all backgrounds and characteristics. And she's also very interested in how inquiry-based learning programmes can help to inspire budding scientists. Julie, we are super excited to be welcoming you today as our Researcher of the Month. We've been wanting to speak to you for quite a long time, so thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I know that you do lots of work, as we've just said in your bio, across encouraging young people to work in STEM. The particular paper that we're going to speak to you about today is a brand new paper that you published exploring the relationship between young people's experiences of school-based career education, information, advice and guidance when they're in secondary school, and the wider adult outcomes when they're adults, when they're about 21 or 22. So I think it's a topic that lots of our secondary and senior schools will be really interested to learn more about and find out how this kind of careers education does impact on later life outcomes.
Yeah, and it was an interesting one because it actually wasn't when we first set out with the ASPIRES project, who the principal investigator is Professor Louise Archer at University College London. As part of our kind of core aims, we're interested in looking at these young people's transitions and specifically into work. But the previous project, we have this large STEM focus, so a lot of our survey work is around science attitudes, experiences in the classroom, science aspirations. But within our survey, we had scope to add a kind of sister and side section of items and questions relating to careers education. And we didn't expect to be able to do the analyses that we were able to. So it's quite an exciting pocket of the ASPIRES work that I'm very excited to talk to you today.
Yeah, I mean, it's really positive and exciting findings, I think. And something that I think schools will be delighted to hear when we start talking about it. So before we sort of get into your paper in more depth, when we talk about schools-based career education, can you just give some examples of the sorts of things that schools are doing in this area and what we mean when we talk about it?
Absolutely. And I think even in the kind of research world, the terminology we use for careers information, advice and guidance, and careers education learning, careers guidance, it can get quite jumbled. So thank you. That's an important one. And I guess in our work, we adopt this kind of umbrella terminology that it's called Hutchinson's conceptualization of career-related learning. And that comprises three parts. So there's the kind of careers education. So that's self-development work, exploring your interests, kind of managing those trajectories. And then work-related learning. So the types of work that young people might consider developing skills for work, but also through work. So work placements. And then this kind of last bit, careers information, advice and guidance, involves those more kind of in-school practices. So for us and in our work, what this meant and what we saw was through asking young people directly, what experiences relating to careers education have you had at school? They reported things like one-to-one career sessions with either a classroom teacher or somebody who works in the school who wasn't necessarily a career specialist, but a teacher that they knew and trusted, or external advisors that were coming into the school. We also had them reporting experience with careers questionnaires, so they would get a list of career topics and kind of doing an interest and scoring to see what careers they might be interested in and might be well suited to them. Also, information and resources provided to them, like websites or some self-research work to do.
Fantastic.
And also just to point out that aside from those activities, there were also kind of curriculum classes that some of them reported having, a kind of careers curriculum class. But that ended up being a bit more citizenship agency type things, not necessarily direct career support.
Wow. So it sounds like schools are doing, a lot of work in this area and a lot of varied work. And I know that your paper notes that young people's transitions from education into employment are a long-standing policy interest. And I think that in England, there's legislation now which actually increases the requirement for secondary schools to provide independent and high-quality careers, activities and support. So before you did your project, what did the existing evidence show about the efficacy of that provision in preparing young people for the world of work?
So being from Canada and having a different education system growing up, I am constantly amazed at how UK teachers can keep up with all of the constant policy reforms. It's a beautiful thing in a lot of ways, and it's great that we are being progressive and things are changing, but it is a lot to keep up with. And I think in answering that, probably to start with a bit of context for England specifically. So there's been a lot of policy work over the last 20 years. The whole system for the careers landscape has shifted. So it used to be that there was a giant amount of funding, I think it was over £200 million allocated for this service called the Connection Centres. And they were devoted and dedicated to kind of helping support schools and running the careers education pretty much. And that shifted in 2010 with the change of government. They decided to axe that funding. And that meant that the statutory duty shifted from the local authority onto these individual schools to secure this independent, high quality careers provision for the young people. So it's something that in the literature and policy circles, it's been intensely debated. There's been lots of concern about how are these schools going to cope with this change. More recently, in I think it was 2014, the government did announce that they were going to provide some new funding for this, for setting up something called the Careers and Enterprise Company. And that was meant to have a similar role, but a bit more directly working with schools to help support the kind of careers education provision. But again, there was a lot of, it's still a huge and daunting task for these schools to be essentially doing the work that they were doing 20 years ago, but without a lot of the funding they used to have. Yeah. So in terms of what evidence there was before we took on this work, I'd say it was, there wasn't a lot, but it has been a concern that's been growing. So people are looking into it. And what the evidence that is there was showing that there are concerns with the provision, that it is not as high quality and more kind of patchy in terms of regions and the types of students who are actually being able to take on that provision, which I think if we think about what's happening for these young people in their lives today, it's a very different world to 30 years ago. That landscape of finding jobs, thinking about all the rapid technological advancements and how that's changing the labor market and all of the different options that they have now to take, which weren't necessarily there. It's a giant landscape and quite a complex one to be navigating. So I feel really strongly that we do need to try to be giving these young people the best support that we can.
Yeah, absolutely. And the teachers, by the sounds of it, because it's
absolutely,
sounds like yet another thing that these very, very hardworking teachers are having to handle without significant amount of guidance, by the sounds of it.
Yeah. And I think for teachers who are already, they have so many obligations within the classroom, outside of the classroom. So to be adding on top of that, this careers education piece and either training up or making sure they have the skills they need to do that properly. I think there was actually some research evidence that was showing at the time, I think off the top of my head is something like, I want to say 60%, but there was a lot of reports of teachers feeling that they weren't equipped to give accurate careers advice, because it's a huge piece of the discipline. That how are you expected to know all the details of different routes and ways students can get into them?
Mm. Are there any sort of training packages or anything that, or resources that you would advise teachers to go to get a sense of greater sort of self-efficacy around delivering this kind of advice?
So I guess each local authority or each head teacher might have specific ones that they prefer and like, but my main advice would be, so after all of this kind of careers landscape changed, they started to implement something called the Gatsby benchmarks. I don't know if you're familiar with, but they had a large piece of work commissioned by Sir John Holman, and he did research looking at kind of internationally what is best practice in careers education. It was a huge piece of work, and he came up with this good career guidance document, I believe it was 2014, and he lays out these 8 principles of what we now know as the Gatsby benchmarks. So that's something that schools actually are kind of held accountable now to, and it's part of the career strategy that more recently, 2018, formed part of the strategy. And so within that, I guess that would be a great resource for teachers to kind of look at that good career guidance. And it is more kind of written for teachers and policymakers versus parents and other kind of connections on that end.
That's fantastic. We'll make sure we link to that in the notes that accompany this podcast. I suspect that I already know what you're going to say to this, but I know that your paper noted that actually provision is quite patchy, or it certainly was when you wrote the paper, and that actually those from the most privileged backgrounds tend to receive more and better provision, and those who are most socially disadvantaged experience the least and the lowest quality provision. Is it becoming more standardized, or does it just really still significantly differ sort of across individual settings and then more broadly across kind of countries? And
yeah, so I think it's a really difficult thing to shift. So to be empathetic with policymakers and teachers and head teachers, this is the things we're talking about. They are hard to implement change, but that doesn't mean that we can't start somewhere and keep working. But in terms of if it's becoming more standardized, I would argue yes. And that is mainly to do with this fabulous Gatsby benchmarks, which have really helped schools, I think, to work toward good practice and to keep them more accountable. So they really do try to scaffold the structure of the support within these 8 benchmarks. And just for some context, the benchmarks include things like it should be a stable careers program. So it's not just a sporadic, we found this expert who's coming in this month. It's a kind of, we have a strategy. This is our yearly plan. These are the people involved, and this is how they are motivated. And everybody is kind of bought into this kind of family-like approach to careers education within the school. And then other things like making sure that the career support content is linked up to labor market information. And that's particularly important, I feel, for helping kind of address this patchiness and the inequalities that if we have different regions that have a kind of skill set that's really needed within their local communities, kind of educating the young people that those options are available and there are lots of available jobs within that area. And it doesn't mean that that has to be what you do pursue, but just to keep that in mind that it's something that can be happening and filtered into the school. So the benchmarks really do help structure that. And I think also on top of these benchmarks, sorry, this is quite a policy heavy chat here, which I do find interesting, but I think teachers and parents might not as much, but there's something called the Baker Clause. And as much as I do love my baking, it has nothing to do with baking, and it's named after Lord Baker. And it was a law that was brought in to basically ensure that specifically secondary schools were helping to engage with in the employment sector. So they had a kind of mandate that said, I think it was they had to have 6 meaningful encounters with education and training providers from year 8 to year 13. So there's a lot of regulations that are in place. And I would be inclined to say that, yes, things are becoming more standardized, but also just with the caveat that it is really tricky to meet these mandates and to have these statutory duties put on schools, and not all of them are able to. So I know, for example, for this Baker Clause, there are several schools that are really struggling to be able to make those connections, because it can be onerous, and if they are not given the support they need to help find those employers, it can be really tough. And then lastly, I guess to say, in terms of standardized internationally or looking to other countries, it might be slightly reassuring, but I think it is not a struggle that's just England. Even countries like Sweden, who I think are often praised for their fabulous education system, they have a similar change that's taken place with over the last 20 years. It's all become a bit decentralized, so more onus on the schools. And then you sometimes run into that if nobody is taking responsibility for it, it can be hard to actually make it effective. There was also a review of internationally the quality of careers education. I think it was 37 countries were also really struggling with same issues. So we're not alone.
Yeah. I'm sure it must be incredibly challenging for schools. I have to say, just as a anecdotally, as a parent, I am staggered by the amount of careers stuff that comes from my son's school. he's in the lower years of secondary school, but
okay.
They're offered so many events. Things are being sent out, you know, to parents all the time. So, you know, schools are, I think, trying really hard to do stuff in this area.
Yeah. Yeah.
Looking at your paper closely, I know that you conducted sort of a large postal survey of young people to find out what their perceptions were of the quality and quantity of careers activities that they experienced when they were between the ages of 14 and 16, I think. And I think you wanted to establish whether there's a relationship between their perceptions of the education that they experienced and their later outcomes at the age of 21 to 22. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a bit about why you chose that question and just a little bit about your methods as well?
Absolutely. So I think in, I guess, with the context of all of these changes in this careers education delivery, we are still seeing lots of concern and issues around the provision. So always looking to thinking how we can motivate teachers, policymakers, parents, and everyone to kind of really see what impact this career support can have on these young people. Mm. And often in academia, we start with looking at attainment outcomes. So that's kind of the main, you'll see several research papers that's our first point of call is, what does it affect attainment? Because if we can get students' grades up, then we help schools deliver lots of performance indicators and everybody's stress levels are reduced from that area. And it's just great. If it relates to attainment, fine. But if it actually doesn't impact their attainment, then we don't have time for it in the school. And that's something that we on the Aspires project, we really have a strong pull away from. So we do value attainment and we, of course, it's important. But beyond attainment, we were really interested in looking at other factors. And I think to get kind of maximal policy buy-in and also head teacher support and those types of things, being able to link these school experiences at the age of 14, 16 to experiences later on in these young people's lives, to have that kind of essentially long-term or semi-long-term impact could really be key to helping provide that evidence and support that these are important activities that we should be investing our time and resources and energy into making them the best that we can for these young people. So yeah, that was probably a key motivation to be looking there. Also, the OECD are really, they're doing lots of work around later adult outcomes and looking at that relationship to school experiences. So that played a key role in this too. We were interested in providing some evidence to help them as well.
It's fantastic. I think you got how many people responded to your survey? 7,635, I think, survey responses. It's quite a big survey.
Yeah, so it's an interesting. The Aspires project has been now going for over 13 years. So we had Aspires 1, Aspires 2, and Aspires 3. And over the three projects, we actually have almost 50,000 survey responses.
Wow.
From young people. Yeah, it's been a huge body of work, but we're really proud of those numbers. And it's been kind of a fourth baby of mine to lead that part of the project. So we've got lots of survey data. And then actually, excitingly, alongside our survey data, we have almost 800 in-depth, longitudinally tracked interviews with young people and their families. So that's actually a sample of about 50 young people who we've spoken to at the age of 10, 12, 14, 16, all the way up until 2023. So it's a mixed methods project that we can kind of pull different bits of data depending on what the question is at hand. And for this particular paper, we were using the survey data and specifically the survey data of the young people aged 21, 22. So yes, that was about 7,000 survey responses.
That's fantastic. Do we know what sorts of activities they were being offered when they were at school? Or were the questions in the survey more focused on their perceptions of the quantity and quality?
So we asked them directly, and just a caveat that it was a retrospective item. So this is them at the age of 21, 22, thinking back, what did you have at the age of 14, 16? So we asked them to respond and also say, did you think it was helpful or not helpful? So they reported, I guess if it's helpful, the exact question was, when you were at secondary school between the ages of 14 to 16, to what extent were the following helpful? And we listed off the activities. So they were things like work experience, placements, mentoring schemes, volunteering, paid work, questionnaires to find out about their abilities, careers advice meetings, job fairs, job shadows, and also workplace visits. And those items were developed based on the young people's responses to interviews over the years. So that's things that they were previously reporting to us that they were experiencing at school.
Fantastic. I mean, your findings are frankly quite striking and I think very encouraging for schools, you know, we'll hear in a minute, but to learn how much of an impact, a long-term impact, when done effectively, this kind of education can have. So could you just talk us through the results a bit and what the links were between careers education and later prospects and outlook?
Absolutely. I guess just start by saying we were quite ambitious with this paper. It was hard not to throw everything that we had into one paper. But for anybody who reads academic papers, that's often what we do. So there's a lot in here. But yeah, I guess the first thing we looked at was their perceptions of future outlook. So we asked them questions like, I am confident with the job that I want to have in the future, or when I think to the future, I feel positive about it. And on the flip side, more negatively worded items like, I'm concerned when I think about what I might be doing in a few years. So it's that kind of positivity when you think forward. Yeah, I am confident that I will have a job that will allow me to live the life I want to live in the future is the specific item. And what we found was that the more career advice and guidance activities that they reported at the age of 14 and 16, the more positive their future prospects were. So there was a positive relationship there. And we found a similar relationship when we looked at their perceptions of being prepared by their schools. So we asked them, how well do you feel that your school or college prepared you for adult working life? And again, we showed that same positive relationship. So the more activities they did, the more likely they were to report feeling more prepared by their school. I think within that one, there was an interesting finding too about different school types. So we found that independent school versus comprehensive school, grammar schools, that there was actually that was a significant predictor of feeling prepared. With independent schools, the pupils that reported being in an independent school were actually twice as likely to report feeling prepared compared to their state comprehensive pupils, and also compared to the young people who were in a grammar school. They were 1.5 times, they had higher odds. So I think there's something around that, which is, it's not new knowledge. We do know that school types, independent school can be a different landscape, differently resourced schools, but that was something that we did flag in the findings. Life satisfaction was an adult outcome that we were interested in too. So what happens in the school, does that impact your life satisfaction later on? And we did find, again, a positive relationship. The more careers activities they had, the higher reports of life satisfaction. And similarly, with their working status or employment and training status, again, the number of career activities they had and the more they found helpful, that predicted employment status. So the young people who had lots of careers activities were more likely to be reporting that they were in work or education and training at the age of 21, 22. And they were less likely to report being something we term NEET in the literature, so not in education, employment, or training. And I thought it would be interesting to add income into this paper. We haven't previously had income data, and this is self-reported income data. And also remembering these young people are only 21, 22. But we didn't find any significant relationship there. So the participating in these activities didn't relate to their future earning outcomes. But I would caveat that by saying that, again, it's quite early on in their earning, and the majority of the sample were in education. The other thing we asked was about job satisfaction. So for those that were in a job, did they see their job as helpful for their long-term career ambitions? Did they think it was an important and worthwhile job? Did it make a contribution to society? So those were the kind of things we asked them that we made a score for job satisfaction. And we did find, again, positive relationships. So these predictors that we put into our models were significant in predicting the overall job satisfaction. So the number of careers experiences, again, was important, and how helpful the experiences were seen by the young people. So those are kind of the main outcomes. So lots of adult outcomes of job satisfaction, whether they were working or not, their views of feeling that the school prepared them, and also their outlook for the future had a positive relationship to the number of the career activities they had at school. Age 14.
It's fascinating. I mean, I'm assuming that we can't say there's a causal relationship necessarily, and there'll be numerous other factors involved as well. And obviously it's retrospective data that you're of people thinking back, and perhaps they're thinking back with rose-tinted glasses. We don't necessarily know. But, you know, it does certainly sound as though it's well worth schools investing in a varied and in-depth careers education program, if these are the kind of outcomes that we're seeing.
I think so. And I think also the fact that the findings flagged that it wasn't just about whether you've had any or not, but that actually the number of activities, so the more activities you had, that was a factor in these relationships. And also your perception of how helpful those activities were was important. So it's not even just we need to give these young people any career support. We need to give them a lot, but also we need to give them as high quality information as we can. But absolutely, the findings do need to be interpreted with caution because it is retrospective. This is also cohort data, so it can't be entirely generalized to the population in England. And also remembering that this is, I guess, one of the key things too, is that the data was collected at a time of some really serious change in that kind of political landscape of careers. So it was a tough time. There were lots of transitions happening. So that's also some of the context of these findings.
That's fantastic. Did you find any gender differences?
So a kind of side gender difference that we found was that there was a significant gender difference for future job prospects. So your future outlook on life, there were, I think, males significantly reporting higher positivity for future prospects.
That's interesting.
Yeah, and I think that kind of links to a lot of research about there are gender differences in confidence levels relating to lots of different things. But also one of the key gender differences for us was in our previous paper relating to careers, that males were actually reporting more careers information, advice, and guidance at year 11 than females, and that it was also patterned by ethnicity and social class. And within that, when we looked to our in-depth interviews, we found that females, because we were looking to why are females not accessing it to the same extent that their male peers are. And actually, the females were reporting that some of them were preferring to kind of have more informal discussions with their parents at home, saying things like they just wanted to go to their dad to talk about that in that safe space at home, doing self-research on their own. And while that's great that they're using the parent domain at home, it does have some potentially worrying implications if we think about differences in social background and the context that some parents might have or might not have. What kind of social capital will they be able to draw from? So that's definitely something that comes into it.
That's really interesting. I know that your paper and your work generally has a STEM focus, so science, technology, engineering, and maths. Do we know, or did you look at sort of the impact of careers education widely on all types of careers, or was this just about science-y careers?
So our project focuses mainly on STEM, and it's a really important question though, because it is something that when we look to follow-on projects, we were always thinking about how do we connect to other disciplines. So there isn't a lot of work that can directly compare kind of science attitudes, for example, in the impact of attitudes toward a subject in different areas. So that would be really important. But yes, for us, it was more of a STEM focus. Although, and just to say that in careers education, it's tricky to get those comparisons because sometimes it's taught as a subject itself, but also through other subjects. So getting that specific data can be a bit nuanced.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Julie. Do you have any examples, sort of moving on to a more practical, rather than looking at your research specifically, do you have any examples of what you'd consider to be great practice in careers education that our schools might be able to learn from?
Oh, good question. Great practices. I think going back to that point about linking up to these Gatsby benchmarks would be a good one. But there's a few published documents about good practice. So Ofsted did a review, I think, in 2022 for the DfE. And one of the things I think they pulled from that was that specifically with leaders, having that strategic plan, that the whole kind of package of the careers program needs to be authentic, contextualized, and personalized. So those would be some really important things in terms of good practice. There's also an initiative called LOUD, so LOUD, and that offers some examples of good practice, but particularly in primary school. So looking at the links of the kind of content there of careers education, but particularly within the primary school curriculum. And it's really neat because it was based a lot on kind of videos, age-appropriate things, follow-up activities in lots of different subjects, but pulling that subject content to kind of make those careers, make the content of the lessons, for example, in geography, kind of relate that to specific careers the young peoples could go on to.
That's really cool, because I was going to ask you about that kind of when do you think that schools should start offering careers education content? And do we know when, I mean, obviously your paper is more focused on the secondary schools, but do we know generally when it has most impact and when, you know, when should we be starting it?
I'd say the earlier that the young people's aspirations are raised and broadened, the better. I think it's that good careers education that kind of creates these moments for young people that can be little kind of bursts of excitement or thinking, oh, well, this might connect to something I want to do later on. So the earlier, the better. But more specifically, if we look at research there for us on the Aspires project, one of our main motivations to start at the age of 10 in primary was that aspirations, there's a real critical phase in the development of aspirations, and it does start early. There's some research that suggests kind of aspirations really don't change very much between the ages of 7 and 17. So getting in early, starting these discussions early can be really key. And also research evidence showing how important aspirations are. So we know that they're not 100% going to tell us exactly what career those young people are going to go on to do, but they are indicative of the types of careers, and a very strong link is definitely present there.
Oh, wow. And that's really interesting about aspiration not changing. That shows just how important those early conversations at school and at home are with young children.
Yeah, I mean, there are lots of nuances, and I'm not saying they are concrete and they do not change, but there is evidence that it really is a critical period in forming those general ideas of what something that interests me might be.
It's really interesting. I think you did a previous paper where you noted that findings offered insight into possible influencing factors and suggest that the majority of careers support is provided via a self-referral system, which could disadvantage those who arguably might benefit the most. Do you have any advice for schools in terms of not only offering support, but sort of actively providing it to the widest possible range of students, those who might not self-refer, perhaps?
Yeah, absolutely. That was a really striking finding for us, that this kind of, it was an opt-in. You had to actively kind of understand what support you needed and then be able to go yourself to access that support. That was a lot of onus to be putting on these young people. And then if we think to kind of gender patterns and ethnic patterns about being able to trust individuals and go wanting trusting resources, it's a tricky one. So what would we suggest for schools? I guess maybe the first point, thinking about just kind of measuring and monitoring. So looking at patterns of what the uptake is looking like in the school. And I guess beyond just looking at what good quality careers education might look like or feel like, it would be, yeah, making sure that we're looking at who's getting it, monitoring and evaluating the strategies that they are using, and reflecting on the structure of that system. So does it need to be self-referral? Why is it? What other implications might that have? I think just to add as well, we had the young people reported that it was too little too late. So it was kind of this idea that the sessions were kind of a one-off chat with a careers advisor external to the school, and it happened after, for example, they'd already picked their GCSE topics. So they really are wanting more involved, more connected, more personalized support.
That's really interesting. So, it's a case of not only just embedding a great program, but, and I'm sure schools do this routinely as they do with all sorts of aspects of curriculum, but also reflecting on how well it's working and who, if it's hitting the people that they want to target.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you think that parents need to be better engaged and informed about career initiatives? And do you have any suggestions of what we might be able to do at home that could help?
I think absolutely. Parents are the key. I think having three little ones myself, it's a bit scary how much of it does fall on us, but that's why we can lean on schools and really work together. But absolutely, there's a lot of research evidence suggesting that parents are an underutilized resource within careers education, and that linking up and communication with schools, it is really, really difficult to do, and so, so important, because it's that whole thing about, I guess, coming back to careers education, but young people, you choose to do jobs that you see. You can't be what you can't see.
Yeah.
So exposing them to lots of different types of jobs, hugely important. But what can we do at home that might help? I think one of our key findings more generally on the project was that the discussions we have at home in a really kind of subconscious way, so at the dinner table, for example, that those discussions can actually have a real significance for young people in terms of how they feel about themselves, and also how they feel about their academic prowess or lack thereof, and what careers are for people like them or like us. So messages are kind of around, well, science is just part of every day. It's what we talk about at the dinner table. We're talking about chemistry. We're talking about medicine. It's just for people like us. So that really can be drilled into the young people, and they then feel comfortable in science spaces. Whereas if we have a family that maybe has lower science capital, they aren't talking about university, they may be saying things like, well, our family don't go to university, you know, nobody has before, that those messages really do impact the young people and can have a significant role in their trajectories. So I guess as a parent, just being aware of those discussions, not necessarily, I'm not at all putting the onus on the parents here, but just realizing that can have an impact on the young people. Being open, being also understanding of what strengths you have, what kind of contacts you have. If you don't kind of looking and reaching to get those. So one of our key findings too was that work experience or work placements were often organized by the parents and the contacts that the parents had, which is great, but also a bit worrying if there are lots of families that don't have those contacts. They don't know somebody who works in electrical engineering. They don't know somebody who's a professional dancer to get those levels of work experience and valuable experiences. So being able to just be open, understanding of what strengths you could kind of build on there. And I would lastly maybe add in too, there's a fantastic resource for parents called Talking Futures, which is delivered by Gatsby actually. I don't work for Gatsby, but I just it's really important work that they've done. And it's been a lot of work with great people. But they've got a great resource online for parents, a whole website devoted basically to talking about careers with your young people. They've got things like Talking Takeaways, which are a takeaway menu that has conversation talking points, because I think that's one of the hardest. It's starting those conversations. It's being open. It's not kind of, it's putting your own views and opinions aside to really understand what your young person wants, what would be the best options for them, and not projecting your own motivations onto them.
That sounds fantastic. We'll definitely get that into the podcast notes too. It's a case of leaning into your child's interests, like being curious about what they are interested in. We've done a lot of work as well with researchers on the importance of dinner time conversations.
Yeah.
Or actually conversations anywhere if you're unable to have dinner together, but, you know, in the car or whatever, on a walk. But yeah, we work with a great researcher at Cambridge called Mashika, who's doing a PhD currently on dinner time conversations and the actually huge impact they have on children in terms of academic achievements, but also just building self-esteem and helping them to think about what they're interested in. So yeah, couldn't agree more with that advice. Finally, what sort of key messages do you think young people should be given about careers in STEM, particularly maybe girls, because we know that there's girls are underrepresented in these fields, but generally just for everybody?
Yeah, so I guess for me it would be, I think it's just so important that we understand that science is really transferable. So it doesn't mean that it's one route and there's only one route to get to that one place. A STEM qualification can open so many doors. It's not that you have to have a career ambition in STEM. Even taking STEM qualification or training route can really benefit you in lots of different ways and provide you lots of opportunities. There are things like, I think a STEM qualification shows that you've got a lower chance of being underemployed, so employed below your skill set. Also looking at this kind of skills gap, there are lots of jobs needed within the sector. So there's definitely a need and availability there. But in terms of a key message for these young people, again, one of our motivations is it's not to turn everybody into scientists or give everybody a science aspiration. One thing we were always asked was, how many scientists do you want? What's your target numbers? What would be good? And that's really not what we're about. I think it's more making sure that we can communicate that science is for everybody. It can be for girls. It can be for absolutely everyone. You do not have to be super elite, super clever, super male dominant, outgoing, confident to be doing these subjects. It really can be for all of us.
Lovely message. And I think you've given us some great ones already, but are there any other resources that you'd really recommend parents and educators could use, or even resources that could help teens explore different career options? I think you've mentioned one already, but
yeah, the Talking Futures one would be great. I think just that point too about being open-minded about your own networks and looking to communicating with schools to kind of build on those. I think in our interviews with young people, there might have also been a bit of a sense that my parent wanted me to do this, so I'm doing it.
Yeah.
And just try. I know it's hard as parents, and we want the best for our young people. But when you go to some of these resources like Talking Futures, also there's one called Youth Employment UK, which is you can enroll your young person on a professional training program that's at home, a series of videos and resources for them, sessions that kind of discover careers. There's something called Parent Kind as well, which is more like webinars for parents to kind of educate them on a range of things. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it can be things like exam stress and kind of settling into reception. But yeah, I think for parents, the big take home would be that there are lots of different options, and those opinions that we have are those kind of, it could be generational knowledge too, and perceptions, opinions of some careers, that they might not be the most updated information, and there might be other options for our young people that are really good, viable options that are great for them. And that would be the key thing.
Well, that's a fantastic message to end on, I think. Thank you so much for speaking to us today, Julie. And do keep us informed about anything else or work that you're doing generally, that we'd love to hear from you again.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
This podcast is brought to you by Tooled Up Education, the home of evidence-based tips on parenting, family life, and education. www.tooledupeducation.com. Parents and teachers in Tooled Up schools can also access notes accompanying each podcast, available to read and download from the Tooled Up site.